Los Angeles, it's the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright lights.
With tonight's guest, producer and director of Glory Days, Ramon Fernandez, and subject Michael Allen.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And musical guest, Kaylee and the Jades. I am Mark Lejeune, and now your host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
You know, this is Filippo, and it's interesting in this day and age how we have this social media, we call it. And something happened to me this past week that I think, wow, this is interesting because we're talking about something very similar here, or a person that, well, hopefully it's not very similar. Here's the story. I got a private message on Facebook from, I won't say her name, but from a young lady who said we went to school together and we were in the same class. And she said, you don't remember me, I'm sure, because I was the quiet one. And but she said she had a lot of wonderful things to say about me. She said, you were quiet too, and I'm proud of you and what you've done and all these wonderful things. And she said, I wish you would remember me, but us quiet ones don't get noticed. Our school was small. The class was small. So, and I don't remember this girl. And I'm thinking, what, we had 30 people in the class? Even if she wasn't in my class, maybe 150 people in the whole school. How do I not know this girl? And I was shy back then, but was she so shy that I actually don't remember her? So I think this is interesting because what did she do? Like, what's that like? I know what it's like. I know what I did with that. Well, today we've got our guest today, who is, as you know, Ramon Fernandez, and we have Michael Alig calling in a little later, and we're going to be talking about this film that's about him. But Michael Alig talks about himself as a disenfranchised boy or young man back then when all of this went down, and we'll talk about exactly what went down. But he was insecure. He said he was escaping reality, and he was seeking out other people that could understand what that's like. And that's interesting because here I am thinking back, like, it wasn't that long ago. I was in a classroom with this girl, and I can't remember her. How she was quiet. Okay, so we know what Michael did, and other kids that sought out Michael, and then for excitement they did weird things that we think are weird, but for them there was like they want to get seen, they want to be heard, they want to, like, somebody notice us. And it was like, wow, this is interesting. I wonder how this relates. So I had to bring that up because I know, especially through Facebook, that sometimes we think we're being seen. And yet on Facebook, because we have so many friends and so many people, and yet how many people are writing these posts that say, if you're actually seeing me, click like, or click a word that you could say that sees me. And it's interesting, Michael Alig actually says this in his new show that he has, and we'll talk about too, on YouTube, where he says it's an addiction and it's not actually serving us because we're not being seen, and we feel it even worse than when we're not being seen in person. Only now there are more people not seeing us, and this is a crazy, crazy thing that's happening. So let's talk about that when we come back with our guest, with our guest Ramon Fernandez, with our guest Michael Alig, and later on we're going to have music by Kaylee and the Jays, which is going to be great. So it's going to be a great show. Stick with us when we come back here on the Life Changes Show.
True performance takes more than just working out. Every day we demand more from our body. But what does your body demand? Hunger is not your body's call for empty calories. It's your body asking for nutrients it's lacking. It's time to reward your body with Boku Superfood, made from the world's finest organic ingredients, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and essential trace nutrients, all developed naturally and organically from nature's most nutrient-dense foods. Boku Superfood is quite possibly the best thing you can feed your body. So listen to your body. Reward it with pure, raw, beautiful food. Boku Superfood.
You are listening to the Life Changes Show, live from Studio NoHo on the BBS Radio Network. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as Marianne Williamson, Gary Anthony Williams, Sharon Stone, and Alex Gray on our archive page at lifechangesshow.com. Or you can visit us online via Twitter at Life Changes Show and Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
So we're back, and Mark, you know, that last statement kind of got me now that I think of it. If somebody's not feeling seen in a room of 30 people, what when the whole world is on Facebook and they're still not seen, that's crazy making.
Well, that's why they say there's the suicide rates are up and divorce rates are up. And, you know, there's this whole disconnection from the connection in social media. because also you have that. Reflection or lack of reflection that you're seeing, but then there's also this projection of their perceived reality or their desired reality, which they're also disconnected with. So they put out a certain persona. They know that they're not living authentically, and then they're not seeing people see them. Why? Because they're not even putting out who they really are in the first place. So it's a bit of a mess if you look at it from that perspective.
It's a bit of a mess. And then something like a Michael Alec, it comes up from society, and here we are, and what a story.
Well, and it's interesting because it makes me reflect on something that a recent guest, Cato Kaelin, had to say on how people had perceived, judged, and condemned him as a character.
Right.
In a show that they saw play out being this trial, which was very real,
yet
they didn't know, or a lot of people didn't know the difference between that or other characters and other shows that they would watch.
Right.
And so he became this character that they saw portrayed by the media, which is completely different than who he is.
Right.
And yet such a defined, judgment was put on him.
And speaking of, I was saying, we were joking during the show with him, but I was saying like, he started messing around and I'm like, here, I wanted a positive interview for you. The one time you had an opportunity for a positive interview and you go and pick on me or something like that. But what did people write about afterwards?
Yeah, actually it was very gratifying. It was very life changing because there was a number of comments that came back about how they had him all wrong, how he seems like a really genuine guy, and they realize how he was not portrayed, in a real light or in a proper light or ever given a chance.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Very interesting. Well, speaking of very interesting, we have our guest here with us in the studio, and this is great actor, writer, director, Ramon Fernandez. Now, he's the director of an award-winning film, Glory Days, The Life and Times of Michael Alec. And the film is basically a legendary urban tale of decadence, debauchery, sin, and ultimate quest for redemption. Now, that's a film I want to see. Probably again and again. and so he's primarily known as an actor. This is kind of his main foray into filmmaking, and the film has already won the Manhattan Film Festival. So kudos to you. Welcome to the show, Ramon Fernandez.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you here.
My pleasure.
Now, I have to say, talk about being seen. He's been seen on The Sopranos, Law and Order, All My Children, Lie to Me, CSI Miami. You play all the happy people.
Yeah, not quite. I actually, 80% of what I do is the evil Latino.
You are freaking scary in the movie. And I've watched your stuff. You scare me.
Yeah.
I mean, you scare me and you're on screen. But here, I met you and it's like, you like come across as nice guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is nice guy.
The real Ramon Fernandez.
Yeah, well, the real Ramon Fernandez, please stand up.
Well, no. Yeah, that's me. And basically, you know, I've been doing this for a while. And listen, I understand that there is typecasting going on in Hollywood. And it always has been that way. Mm. And I'm certainly not going to, you know, bite the hand that feeds me. I am, you know, somebody, if I don't play it, someone else is going to play it. It does tear me a little bit because I am propelling and I am, you know, continuing the notion that all Latin men are, you know, no good and criminals and rapists and so on. And that does tear you a bit. But on the other hand, I am an actor. That is what I do. Mm. And
well, not the only thing, obviously.
But, right. And it's not all that I do, yeah, you know, but I do get paid for my intensity, if you may. Whether
yeah.
It's, whether it's a cop, it's usually a corrupt cop. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, it's always somebody that has some menace behind him, which is actually very far from who I am as a person.
Well, where does that come from? Because it has to come. Where do you get, what do you do to get that? Well, do you think of the bully at school when you were a kid? Where do you go?
I think we all have a degree of madness and anger and ferocity that we can tap into that most of us walking through society have been told to keep under wraps. And, you know, it's my job to tap into all of those things. You know, what would I look like as a convict? What would I look like as a rapist? What would I look as these people? And so it's part of the quest of trying to get there. But I think it's we all have the capability of being really scary if put under the right circumstances, as Michael Alec was all those years ago.
Wow. Well, so then, you know. When we come back, actually, I want to talk about obviously the film, but you directed the film and you also wrote it and you produced it. So I want to talk about what got you on that side of the camera.
Sure.
And then we'll talk about why this particular subject. And a little later on, we'll actually be talking to Michael Alec himself, live from New York. So this is quite exciting. We'll do all that when we come back right after this.
Bring it.
Listen to these words. He would not be beat by forces too fierce for man, woman, or beast. As the going got tougher, his courage increased. It's a little story with a big message, a message that speaks to children of all ages. It's about believing in yourself, overcoming obstacles, and never giving up. It's been called a masterpiece, one of the finest children's books ever written, and a true children's classic. Shadow Stevens has been called Dr. Seuss for the 21st century. His big little book, The Big Galoot, is a story about bullying. Bullying has become an American epidemic, and The Big Galoot talks about it in a way that will touch the heart of a child of four and a grandfather of 104. It's the story of a little boy with size 42 hands, the biggest hands anyone has ever seen, and the kids laugh at him. Then the laughter turns mean. They mock him and trip him, and much worse. But throughout it all, Warren Galoot says, I'm a galoot, but I have good luck. You can't get me down. I never give up. A second grader named Chandler said, I thought it was the best funny book I have seen in my life. And we agree. Whoopi Goldberg said, this is a great story. Bravo, Shadow. The Big Galoot is available now as an ebook exclusively on Kindle Fire on Amazon for only $3.98. We strongly urge you to get it for your children, your children's children, or as a gift to yourself. Its message speaks to all of us. Have good luck and never give up. Go to Amazon.com and search for The Big Galoot by Shadow Stevens.
You are listening to The Life Changes Show, live from Studio NoHo on the BBS Radio Network. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as The Green Children, Dan Millman, Hot Rod Fuller, and Mike Marino on our archive page at LifeChangesNetwork.com. You can also follow us online via Twitter at Life Changes Show and Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
Okay, we're sitting here with our guest, Ramon Fernandez. I am Filippo Voltaggio, and Mark Lejeur is co-hosting. And Actually, Mark, you and Ramon know each other. I mean, you're friendly.
We do know each other, and I'm honored to have him here with us. He's a guy that when I first met him, it was very clear he was good people, and that continued to grow as I got to know him better. So he's one of the good guys, despite all the guys he plays.
I have to make up for it somehow.
Despite all the guys you play. Well, speaking of. So that these are the kind of roles that people see you in, and then now you went on the other side of the camera to make this film.
So yeah, a lot of people get into this business, I think, for the wrong reasons. They get into the business for what goes around acting, the glamour and the glitz and the fame and the thing. And as the old saying goes, everybody wants to be famous, nobody wants to put in the work. So. You know, the difference, I think, is if you either want to be an artist or do you need to be an artist. There's a big difference. And if you need to be one, then if you're not getting to work, then it's going to, like a pressure cooker, it's going to come out somewhere else. In other words, as an actor, you don't get to choose necessarily when you get to do your thing. Like 60 people have to do their job before I hear the word action. And then the set belongs to me and I get to do my thing. So if you're not going to, if you know, I might work in for a week and then I might not work for another 4 months and then you book another part. You might not work for 8 months. You might not. So right. In the meantime, what do? So, you know, you start to, and I love film.
That passion's still inside
you. Still inside you. So what are you going to do? Obviously, we have many more means now than we used to shoot. We have digital cameras. We have legions of kids that are coming out of film school with great equipment, and they don't know what to do with it. So you are able to assemble a crew, and you're able to make your own movies a lot easier now than back then. So, and especially a documentary where you don't have to ask for permission. And you get final cut.
And tell your story.
Tell your story, yeah. So then I basically, you know, went behind the camera and where you're able to basically, you know, take control of the story as much as you can a documentary because it pretty much writes itself. You kind of know what story you want to tell, but you really don't know what answers you're going to get. We were fortunate enough to be able to get 43 interviews because this film took 5 years to shoot. So
this is 43 different people?
43 different people, yes.
Wow.
Of an hour each. Everybody shot on four different cameras, four different angles, which led to the energy of the cutting. You know, so everybody sort of, there is no voiceover. I didn't want any kind of farce in the film. Didn't want animation, reenactments, voiceovers, none of that. So basically it's one person finishes each other's sentence and it goes on into the next and they tell the story for me.
It's really masterful because it touches on various threads that are all difficult conversations on their own right, and yet getting that kind of second and third party validation one after the other, and then the perspectives coming in from slightly different angles is
we managed to cover a lot of ground. You know, we spent 3 decades of New York City nightlife laced in with Michael's personal story within that. You know, so if we start with a very sort of decadent 70s New York, kind of like what you saw in Taxi Driver, you know, just really graffiti and dirty, and nobody thought, you're looking at 4 decades of decadent of decay. And then, you know, Giuliani comes in and washes everything clean to the point where it took the party with it. And that was sort of the end of it. And it led to the new New York that we have now, which is a lot more sanitized and a lot more, you know, you're able to raise a family there without, you know, getting shot and so on, which was you know, back in the day, it wasn't that way at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that needed to be documented.
From Warhol to washed clean.
Exactly. It's
so interesting. So in one film, you accomplished actually quite a bit of things. I mean, you did more than tell one story. You told more than now. And Mark, you've seen the film. I haven't actually. I'm going to go see it at the premiere. So actually, tell us about that.
Yeah, the premiere is happening at the ArcLight on the 24th and the 26th. We have two screenings for the Hollywood Film Festival. The link will go out today. We're very happy to have our West Coast premiere here, and really looking forward to it and see. I mean, even though it's a very New York story, I think people will be able to relate, given that this is a large city, and you know. You mentioned that I touched on a lot of things, and you know, you have to remember that people go to the movies to feel. But if you learn something on the side, that's also good.
Let's talk about the story here because it's going to touch a lot of people. A lot of people, of course, knew of the scene that we're, mm-hmm. that you're going to talk about, and also the scene kind of had its spread throughout, and different cultures came because of the scene. So
it goes to the way you opened the show and being unseen. You know what happened here was, and this is before the internet. You know there were what we call freaks. You know, the outsiders, the people that nobody really talks to,
right?
All over the United States,
right?
And Michael was sort of the captain of them, and he made it okay to be that, whatever it is that you want to be, and not only that, okay, but to celebrate it.
Well, so, in his case, he is gay.
Oh yeah,
and so that alone was not okay.
Exactly.
Where he was,
right,
in his family or whatever.
We've come a long way in 20 years, believe it or not.
So, right, which is a whole other story. But yeah. But go on. So he, just being gay already, right. People, he was an outsider.
Right.
So he kind of created a culture.
He created his own scene,
right.
Sort of inspired by Warhol's factory and family and so on. And sort of, he was not accepted in the status quo. It was the death of Warhol. It was the death of downtown. It was a very anticlimactic sort of dark ages period for culture in New York. It was a sort of changing of the guard. And he came in like a bull in a china shop and just took over and made his own scene with all of the outsiders. They basically created their own army. And people were leaving home and running to New York to join this scene. And he ended up with a few hundred people under his belt, all on payroll, you know, and they would give you a job, whether it was handing out flyers, whether it was bartending, whether it was coat check, whether it was whatever. And,
wow.
You know, they basically ran New York City nightlife for a good 10 years.
Wow. You know? Like where they said the party was, that's where it was at, kind of thing.
That's pretty much it. And yeah,
and it grew outside of that, because it wasn't just now the word that they were using at the time was freaks, right? So yep. It wasn't just the freaks. It's like everybody started coming in. Wall Street, like that's where it's happening.
It became cool to be a freak.
It became cool.
Yeah, and back then, you know, it wasn't segregated at all economically as it is now. There was no such thing as bottle service, which is a huge thing. Whereas now you go to a club, you buy a bottle, and you're protecting your territory. And you don't go to other parts of the club and visit with other people, and you're hoping that some girl in a tight black dress wants a free drink. Back then, it was really the great equalizer. You went on the dance floor, and rich, poor, black, white, gay, straight, didn't matter. Mm. You were there for the music, and you all became sort of one. And that was really amazing, and something that I never thought would disappear, and it really did.
This particular period, I'm curious now personally, because you mentioned the Limelight and you said it was a church, mm-hmm. right? And I remember the first time I went to New York, I ended up at the Limelight at the church, and I thought, I'd never seen anything like this before in my life. Now that, I think, was either 88 or 89. So where am I?
You're right about there. You're right.
Seriously.
About the beginning of, right when it just about started.
Wow.
Yeah, the beginning of the Club Kid era.
Wow, it was freaky, the different rooms and the different...
Different
you know,
musics, different rooms, different DJs, different looks.
Different looks. And, I mean, people in cages. Right. I mean,
and debauchery.
Hanging from the...
Debauchery.
Yeah.
There was
and,
open...
And gay, straight, it was everybody. Right.
Yeah. It was just... The unifier was the music. That was it.
Yeah, and different music than I never heard.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So those were, you know, those times. And, you know... It goes to, again, to what you were saying, you know, with Michael. Now that once he got out of prison and, you know, he's had a chance to figure out what, because he went to prison for 17 years.
Well, and actually tell us why, because people might not know.
Okay. So, yes. The party got out of hand, basically. Michael started doing way too many drugs. And at first he didn't. He hated drugs. But little by little, it started creeping into the scene. And it got all the way down to, you know, heroin and really hard stuff. And they were mixing drugs, something like that was called Zek, which was Xanax, Ecstasy, Crystal, and K.
Wow.
You know, just absolute monstrosities. And it got so crazy that, you know, at one point, Alec got into a fight, a dispute with his drug dealer at Alec's house. And they had a fight.
Alec
ended up, Angel was his name. Mm-hmm. And Angel ended up getting hit by a hammer by Michael, Alec's roommate. And Michael ended up putting a pillow over his head, and they suffocated him. And they panicked. They're drug addicts. They didn't want, you know, to have to answer questions to the police as to why you're drug addicts or this and that. Because at this point, he was still a victim. Michael Alec had been attacked by Angel, who had started this whole thing. Mm. And if he had basically called the police at that point, you know, it would have been bad, but not as bad as it got, because they basically didn't call anybody. They put the body in a tub. They did all the drug dealer's drugs. And they came back to the apartment 7 days later, and they basically hacked up the body and dumped it in the Hudson River, which ended up being found in Staten Island. And he went to prison for 17 years. So, you know, sitting across from somebody who's committed such a heinous crime, it was at first a little daunting because you don't do that every day. But, you know, when you get to know him and you get to talk to him, you really start to see that, you know, there is a human being in there somewhere, you know, that messed up, obviously. And I'm certainly not condoning it, and I'm certainly not trying to create sympathy for him. Again, I'm trying to create empathy.
And you don't glamorize the story, that's for sure.
Right. Not at all.
You're not glamorizing.
Basically, it's documentary. You show what happened, and you make up your own mind as to what you think of the subject.
You know, it's really a deep, deep conversation, because you think of all of the people that have had a little too much to drink and have done something stupid, some kind of mistake, something that they regret, you know, something angry or whatever the case may be. And then you're talking about that level of drugs and that level of insanity. Yeah. And then the punishment that comes with the crime, yet you know you can't be in your right mind, and you know it's a really deep discussion.
Yeah.
To as you said, to look at him as a human and step back and kind of understand the big picture of it all.
Right. And to go back to what you were asking me before, of how do I play these characters? Again, it's inside all of us. You know, under the right circumstances, we're all capable of a lot of things that we don't think we would be capable of. You know. And I opened the film with a line from Sidney Lumet, which says, freaks are not the freaks we think they are. We are much more connected to the most outrageous behavior than we'd like to admit.
Wow.
Which is sort of the theme.
You know, when Michael comes on a little bit, I don't know that we need to talk about all this. I'd kind of like to get it out of the way. So I think it's important for people to know, because I didn't know this actually, that he can't make money off of the film, or right? So tell us about that.
He can't profit from there's something in New York called the Son of Sam laws. Son of Sam was a serial killer who tried to terrorize the city in 1977, 78, I think. And then he tried to write a book about it and try to profit from it. So they passed a law that says that you can't commit a murder and profit from telling the story of it. So no, this is something that he can't monetarily partake in, but it does give him sort of, it shows his side of the story. It shows, you know, it tells a story of him sort of, yes, trying to get some degree of redemption for it. And I don't think that monetary gain was ever the intention in the first place for him participating in the film.
Could I ask you, what is your, this is a very particular subject matter. Mm-hmm. What was your either fascination or personal interest in telling this story?
Yeah, I was there in the 90s. I got to New York in 1994. So it was sort of in the middle of the whole thing. And I worked on Wall Street at the time.
Uh-huh.
And those clubs were my escape. I would able to literally let my hair down when I had some and go out and listen to this new type of music that was still being sort of invented, electronic music.
So you were a suit.
I was a suit that put on big, huge, you know, UFO pants on the weekends, and I was a raver. And so I would go and dance at these parties and do my thing, and it was great. And I never thought I was going to end, you know.
We had probably met because I was in a suit in New York
at
the same time.
Well, there you go. But I had an escape on the weekends. And then what happened was 9/11 happened, and Giuliani cleaned up the city, and it all went away. It all disappeared. And I never thought that that would be the case. It was a major source of industry. It was a major industry in New York City that basically the government decided they didn't want it anymore.
Wow.
Just made it go away. Yeah.
So it was your party, and it was taken away.
Yeah. And so years later, as an artist, I've always had a thing for forgotten kings, people who used to run things at one point, another era that time sort of discarded. I've always been very interested in that, and sort of the how fleeting success can be. And I was asking, you know, once he was forgotten virtually 5 years ago. And I was asking a friend who ended up being the, you know, Lisa Brubaker, who ended up producing the film with me, wonder whatever happened to Michael Alec. And she told me that she knew somebody, Steve Lewis, who still visited him in prison. I asked to send a message, you know, what would Michael think about me doing a documentary about coming? I'd never done a documentary in my life, but I figured I'd put out there, you know, the hook in the water. And months later, they came back with saying that he was interested. We went up to the prison, interviewed him, asked him if he wanted to do it, and he said yes. So 43 interviews later and a year of cutting later, here we are about to premiere the film. So we're ecstatic.
This is exciting. And, well, it's premiering here on the West Coast,
right.
But it won the film festival on the East Coast, exactly. In Manhattan.
Yeah, so we saw it there. And he had an emotional time watching it. A lot of his friends were there. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the third act, because that's really, you know, Michael Alec spent, imagine what 17 years to have spent in prison. He missed the whole technological revolution.
Right.
So he comes out, he had never been on the internet. He didn't know what a cell phone was. He hadn't watched Party Monster. He had never seen Times Square without the
hookers. Right, because Party Monster, that film is about him.
It's about him.
With
Macaulay Culkin played him.
Right.
And so, and I have him watching the movie in my film. So that's it all ties in.
Oh, seriously? Yes. For the first time?
Yes, for the first time.
Wow.
So it was very interesting. And what he says, to tie it into what you were originally talking about, when he finally got to chat with people online and Twitter and this, and he's got like 45,000, I think, followers at this point. He said that, yes, I have 100 more people that I can talk to, but the connection in the conversation is probably 1/100th of the depth that it would be if it was in person.
Wow. Wow.
So, quantity versus quality.
That's interesting.
Give or take. And that's his take on it. This is basically a man who has traveled from 1997 in a time machine to here now. And in one interview, he mentioned that it felt like he was stepping into Blade Runner. Which I guess makes sense.
Wow. Yeah. Fascinating. Fascinating. Well, we'll be talking to him when he comes back. That's Michael Alec. Ramon Fernandez will stay with us, of course, and we look forward to that. And a little later on, we're going to have the music of Kaylee and the Jays all here on the Life Changes Show.
You are listening to the Life Changes Show live from Studio NoHo on the BBS Radio Network. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as Mariel Hemingway, Shadow Stevens, Gary Zukav, and Kyle Cease on our website at lifechangesshow.com. You can also follow us online via Twitter at Life Changes Show and at Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
You're done with me?
We are back, and our guest is Ramon Fernandez, and we have Mark Legere and myself in the studio, and Michael Alec on the phone. Michael, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Awesome. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You got a big smile out of Ramon when he heard your voice.
Really?
The two of you have gotten to know each other well, I take it.
Is that what they call a Mona Lisa smile?
Well, I'm sure he knows a lot, and actually
too much.
You too much?
Yeah,
probably.
I have to ask you, what was your reaction to the film? Of course, well, I'll mention again, we're talking about Glory Days. What was your reaction when you saw it?
Which one? I mean, you know, it's difficult sitting in a crowded room and watching sort of your life's history being flashed upon the screen in front of everybody. You know, it's kind of invasive, and, you know, I've told people that it feels kind of like a consensual rape because, I mean,
wow.
Of course I allowed them in, but then once they're there, it's kind of like, you know, am I sure I really want to let everybody see all the, you know, what's inside of my head, you know?
Wow. Yes. And it's not like you're watching yourself get an Academy Award or being awarded something.
You know,
it's
I have to imagine, you know, what I want my mother to see this, what I want my grandmother, you know. My grandmother died just before the movie came out, the other movie, you know, the actual movie. And thank God for that.
You know, I have to believe that on some level it's going to be good for people to go through this story. And do you believe that on some level?
What do you mean?
Well, there's a reason you said yes, and I think your reason is beyond, like, you didn't want to glamorize this. So what was the reason you said yes to making the film?
Well, I mean, honestly, in the beginning, the reason I said yes was because I was in prison and I wanted people to come visit me and I wanted some attention and people, you know, somebody to talk to. I mean, I was in protective custody at the time. There weren't a lot of people. I wasn't out of my cell a lot. I didn't have a lot of, you know, human contact. And frankly, I just wanted people around. But then once I met Ramon and we got talking and he seemed like kind of like, he'd been around the club scene, you know, before. But once I got to talk to him and see what he wanted to do and what his ideas were about the documentary, it made me feel a lot more comfortable. And I thought, you know, maybe this is a good way to get, you know, more of the real me out there instead of this caricature that has been portrayed.
Ah, nice. Okay. And so you have been now, the film was premiered in Manhattan. It's going to be premiered here on the West Coast in a week or so.
That's right.
So in the meantime, however, the film was shot a little over a year ago, and you've been back in this life about a year. What are some of the major changes that you've experienced in this year? I know you've started a YouTube channel, which you never had before.
Right. Well, I never had YouTube before.
Well, there was no YouTube, right? That's right.
Right. Right. There was no YouTube. There were barely cell phones. That's one of the biggest things I've done is kind of become, you know, familiarize myself with the internet and computers and just, you know, being able to sort of effortlessly, you know, surf the web and things like that.
You know, we've been talking about some of the things that you have said in other interviews about being disenfranchised and insecure and trying to escape reality. And the interesting thing is that Ramon was saying earlier that one of the reasons he was interested in the film is because he was on Wall Street, used to wear a suit and then used to change clothes, put on a costume and go party. And that's kind of been taken away. So people are still disenfranchised. People are still insecure. People are still trying to escape reality. And obviously, that's not there. And drugs isn't a good idea, right? So what are you thinking is the new way of doing it healthy?
I mean, you know, it's funny you mention that because that's something that I learned just in the past 5 years or so, is that everybody feels that way. You know, you feel like you're the only one who feels insecure and you're the only one who feels disenfranchised or in a prison or whatever, but everybody feels that way. Whatever they're doing, it's, you know, it's kind of the grass is always greener thing. They want to be doing something else. But, I mean, I think now, you know, if you take away clubs and take away drugs, I mean, the only thing left really is meditation. And the Western culture is sort of going in that direction toward, like, Eastern, you know, Eastern philosophy and, you know, holistic medicine and things like that. So, I mean, that started in the 70s with the hippies, but it's gotten a lot more intense now.
I would not have expected you to say that. Wow.
You wouldn't?
Meditation? Interesting.
That's the obvious one, isn't it?
Well, let me ask you this. You know, five years...
What's more obvious? I don't know.
Good for you. Good for you. 5 years in solitary confinement. Was that the start of meditation at one point?
Yes, it was, absolutely. It was kind of forced meditation. Well, no, actually, in the beginning, say 18 years ago, the first year I was there, I was having a really difficult time, you know, obviously, and my therapist and a psychiatrist mentioned meditation, and some friends sent me some cassette tapes that, you know, listen to on a Walkman that kind of walked you through it, because reading it was always the issue. I just didn't want to read it. So they sent me some cassette tapes and I just listened to them at night and fell asleep, you know, doing whatever they were telling you to do, stretch your toes and count, you know, hold your breath and things like that. And it really, really did help. I really became a firm believer at that point. But then prison got really wild, and it's difficult to meditate in prison because it's very loud and people are banging on the walls and throwing things and, you know, whatever. So I didn't really get back into it until I was in solitary confinement.
Wow.
Wow.
So can we talk about, you were obviously, well, you were known as the club king, the kid.
King of the club kids.
The club kids, the king of the club kids, right? And so we actually didn't introduce you properly. I should say former club kid impresario and the real party monster. But I mean that sounds almost like a negative connotation. But you were the epitome of cool at the time.
Were now that's the negative connotation. I mean,
oh seriously, the epitome of cool.
I mean, I don't think it's something you necessarily lose just because you get older. You know,
nice.
I mean, and I know it sounds cliche, and it is cliche, but it's cliche for a reason. I think that 50 really is the new 30. And, I mean, listen to the radio. You would have, 20, 30 years ago, you would have never heard a 60-year-old pop star on the radio. It's just, people are extending their youth into, you know, God knows when. I mean, by the time I'm, you know, 60, Stephen Hawking says we'll be living in the singularity, so maybe we won't care anymore about how, you know, what you look like. So I really think that it's, I mean, I know it's, again, cliche, but age really is just a number.
And what's interesting is that you were the epitome of cool, but you did it by being the anti-cool.
Cool is the anti-cool. You know,
right?
I got into so many arguments in prison because guys were telling me, oh, when I open up a club, I'm going to have the most popular club around. It's going to be so cool. And it's like, no, if it's the most popular club, then by definition, it cannot be cool. And they said, no, everybody's going to be there. It'll be cool, popular. And they don't understand once something is cool, I mean, once something becomes popular, it's no longer cool.
Dead.
So it's for what Ramon said, is the cool is really the anti-cool.
That's the coolest.
Come on,
hence meditation, because it's not cool yet.
Precisely.
Well, I think it's actually becoming cool.
Oh, it has it. Okay.
It was not cool in prison, I'll tell you that, because they forced us to do it in NA, and the guys were rebelling and going to, if you don't do what they tell you to do, they put you in solitary, and people were getting in trouble on purpose to get out of meditation. They were on purpose, you know, causing a disruption in order to go to solitary to get out of meditation.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, it's almost like, you know, a psychiatrist would say they didn't want to be forced to go inside their heads, you know.
You know, speaking of psychiatrists, you mention your therapist a lot in the various interviews that I've heard, and I actually love it. I'm a life coach, and Mark is a coach as well, and Dorothy is a spiritual leader. So you sound like you're getting quite you were obviously a very intelligent person to begin with, and now you're adding this information. Is that accurate?
Which part? I think all of it is pretty accurate. They say that you don't get a lot of quality care in prison, but that's really not true, especially in the Department of Mental Health and the Department of Corrections are two different entities, and they're kind of at odds with each other. And the way they look at it is if you want it and they know that you want it and you're working with them and you're answering their questions and you seem like you're learning something, they will give you all the help you want. They will give you all the therapy. They'll give you all the training. They'll give you anything you want, really, because nobody wants it in there. So they've kind of got a lot of spare time on their hands. They've got, you know, people don't want to go to therapy or want to be, you know, psychoanalyzed. So there's a great opportunity there for somebody who has to spend a lot of time in prison, I guess.
And you did why? Just so you'd have somebody intelligent to talk to or something? Or
learning a lot. I was learning a lot. Like, you know, when I went to prison, I really didn't know. I felt like I was an adult, but I wasn't at all. Not even close. And I believed, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know that then. But I didn't really know who I was. And so I believed whatever the media told me. If the media told me that I was a genius, then I was a genius. It said that I was a sociopath, then I was a sociopath. And I didn't even know what a sociopath was, but I knew that it was bad. And when I looked it up, it so upset me that that's when I began my psychoanalysis with my psychiatrist, because it was so upsetting to me. And he wouldn't tell me in the beginning if I was a sociopath or not. And I didn't know why he wouldn't tell me. The fact that he wouldn't tell me, to me, meant that I was. And in the end, he said, he acted like, oh, I forgot that you'd asked me. And he said that, no, I wasn't. And he explained to me why I wasn't. And it all made so much sense that I really just wanted to stay. I didn't want to leave. I was when I was finished with my psychoanalysis, I wanted to stay. So they let me.
Wow.
You are doing something very interesting with your PU show. And so we'll talk about that. And what one of the things that I find the most interesting is that you're talking about anything and everything, and it's kind of no holds bar. And let's start with that. It's just like very raw and very real to your life.
It's not as raw and real as I'd like it to be.
Really?
It was supposed to be raw and real, and we were supposed to just turn the camera on, because our morning conversations at the breakfast table were always, we thought, really funny. I thought Ernie was funny, and Ernie thought I was funny. And we were always saying, this would be a great morning show. And the idea was to just put the camera on us. When we put the camera on us, Ernie especially really clammed up. And so we figured that we have to at least write down the things that we're going to talk about. And then that turned into write down the things we want to talk about and then write bullet points and then write detail, you know, and it turned into kind of writing a script. And there are things that we have to stay away from because we know that we will be, you know, probably stoned. and things I'll say one thing. We never have done a retake. We never do edits. We never cut anything. We just go with it. If we don't like it, we don't air it. But we've never had an episode that didn't air. But we know that there are things that we cannot talk about. There are kind of, there are boundaries.
Like
we didn't
taboo.
Want there to be.
You now have many Twitter followers and many tens of thousands of Twitter followers, and people are following you on YouTube and all the shows you've done. I think over 300 shows. What would you say is the main message you are getting out in all of what you're doing right now?
I think it's that that it's never too late to start over again. When I was in prison, and I told this story before, but it's kind of important. I think it's kind of the crux of everything. When I was in prison and I was, you know, in my mid-40s, I didn't stop using drugs because I felt I had no reason to. I felt like I was going to come home to male friends and never get a boyfriend and never find a job, and nobody would ever forgive me, and I would never forgive myself. And so kind of, what's the point? I really didn't see any point. I didn't think that I could start again. I thought that it was too late. And my psychiatrist kept telling me that it wasn't too late, and if I stopped using drugs, that my friends would come back, and I would get boyfriends, and I would get job offers, and I would have basically my life back again. And I didn't believe her, and I kind of tried it on a dare, just sort of like, you know, I'm going to do it, and I'll prove that you're wrong, I'll prove that I will never get any friends or whatever. And I did it, and I would say 5 months, five, 6 months later, I really noticed a change. I mean, normally I would stop for like 3 weeks and I'd think, well, nothing's changed. I'm not, you know, my life isn't, I'm not happy. My friends aren't back. And then I would go back to drugs. I didn't realize it really takes a year. I mean, you really have to stop for like a year before you kind of get rewired again and become the person you were before, if you can ever go back that far. But, you know, after 6 months, a year, I really felt like that person again. I felt like I kind of felt 18 again. I felt like I went to New York for the first time. And when I came home, you know, my friends were all here. There were job offers. There's all this media attention. I mean, it really was something. And I think that's a really important message because I was really at the end of, I thought, my life. And it really is never too late. You can turn over a new leaf at 50, at 60, at 70. I mean, I think that's a really important message.
I think it's a very important message also. You know, Michael, I think you'd be a great person to talk on this. I appreciate your openness and honesty here. And speaking of disenfranchised and because of that and insecure and all that stuff, and maybe because the party has been taken away, or there's so much responsibility these days, or I don't know what it is, but I have friends that don't know how to let go, and they're doing the drug thing. And to me, they're mm-hmm. going hard.
Because it's
going,
the easiest thing to do.
Unfortunately, you're probably right. Yes.
And we're Americans, and we are trained to go the easiest way.
So
you're right.
So they, in other words, take a pill for it. So to me, they're hardcore, and it scares me because a couple of them have been close to death. Now, that's until I heard the stuff that you were doing. So you're saying, you're talking from a sober person that has turned that around. So talk to me about this aspect of what I hear always is, oh, but when you're starting to do it, it's so good.
Well, obviously it is. I mean, why do you think people become addicted? Because it's so good. You know, people don't become addicted to picnic tables. You know, I mean, it replaces everything. I was in search of love. I was in search of validation, and drugs replaced all of that. I didn't need that anymore. You know, I didn't need to go chasing all of these things. I just needed to go chase the drug dealer, and he was easy to go to chase because he didn't run very fast. He stopped and he turned around and he handed them to me. So it was just really easy and comfortable. And I really thought that I'd found the answer, and I didn't even notice it turning into something else because it happened so gradually. You just, all of a sudden, you're not having fun anymore. You're just surviving. You're doing it not to go out and have fun. You're doing it to exist, in order to wake up and be able to talk to people and, have the strength to go buy more drugs, you know? I mean, it's an awful cycle.
I should point out to people while we're talking about this, it's not like you were on Skid Row looking for more drugs. You had everything you wanted, said.
I was there.
You had a house, right?
But I went home afterwards.
Yeah. You had everything. You had a house. You had money. You could travel. You had a lot of friends.
Everything. Yeah, I had everything that I thought that I wanted. Everything that I had dreamed of as a child. And looking back, I just cannot believe how fortunate I was. I mean, actually, I'm very fortunate now. I was extremely fortunate. And you know, I did a lot of thinking, especially in solitary. And it was at the time when they were talking about, they're having the riots and New York, and they were talking about the 1%. And I was thinking, America is 5% of the world, roughly, population-wise. And to be in the top 3% of America, you only needed to make something like $300,000 at the time. I was making over $300,000. So I was at least in the top 3% of the top 5%, which means I was really like in the top 0.001% of the world, which is kind of like being one out of a million. You know, it's more than one out of a million, or it's less than one out of a million, and that's like winning the lottery. And I, you know, we live in Manhattan, and we're surrounded by all this luxury and all these people with money, and you don't realize how fortunate you are.
Wow.
I do now.
And you do now.
But my friends don't, and it's kind of disgusting sometimes when I go out and I see how people are, you know. I mean, I know that sounds awful, and it sounds hypocritical. But it's true. I mean, you know, I see myself on video, the clips of me in the past, my video, and I just cringe. I can't believe anybody wanted to be my friend.
Well, obviously people like you wanted to be your friend, and then when you became famous and you know, the party king, then others wanted to know you as well. Plus, you were taking them out of their humdrum life, which is another thing that concerns me. I, obviously, Michael, with all the experiences you've had, an interviewer like myself and like Mark, there are a million questions we could ask, but we're staying away from the obvious questions for many reasons. And one of them is because we want people to go see Glory Days, The Life and Times of Michael Alec, because obviously you sanctioned it. And so there's truth that comes through it and a story that comes through it. And so we'll let the film and speak for itself. But since we have you, a couple more questions. You say that the gays are becoming boring, like the straight people. Straight people are boring. How does, you know, it's like, wow, we're all doomed. How do we not be boring?
Well, in a way you are. We are, because, you know, gay people, evolutionarily speaking, have a real purpose in society and in mankind. And they're, the fact that they're disenfranchised, you know, artists become artists because they have something to say and because they need to change something, mostly. And gay people, that's kind of their mission in life. It's the fact that they're different. They soothe a culture. They have no children, so they can take care of other children, and they can be caregivers, and they can give, they can create art, and they do things that soothe a society. And they do that out of necessity because they don't fit in and they feel like they have to change it. They have to make things better. And if by making them fit in, by giving them gay marriage and making them just like straight people, I fear that we're going to take that disenfranchisement away and then we're going to become more bland because of it.
Okay, so last question. You were a child who was disenfranchised and you had all of the insecurities and all that. So you wouldn't want your child, I would imagine, or anybody that you love to go through some of the things that you went through. So what? This is kind of like a dichotomy here. On the one hand, you think disenfranchisement is a good thing because it could breed, you know, mm-hmm. And yet
I do. Yet. Yes. I know what you're saying. And I do. It's sort of like, you know, I don't like the way cough medicine tastes, but I know that I have to take it. And so I'll take it when I have a cold or whatever, you know. It's kind of the bitter pill that you have to swallow in order to lead a better life. You know, it's kind of like Joan Crawford not leaving her kids any money and making them work for it. Because she knows that. That it's the struggle. Life is all about the struggle. Once you don't have a struggle, you become complacent. And if you don't, you know, like, look at the country. Look how fat we are. I mean, we're just, it's awful how fat and disgusting we are. And it's because we have enough money to be. So, you know, it's the same kind of thing. If you take away the disenfranchisement, you'll take away the struggle. And then what will be left?
Well, I ask you this as we get ready to say thank you for being on and all that. But if you had a little Michael Alec that entered your life, I feel like, would you hug him and love him and try and show him a better, different way?
Oh my gosh, that's such a silly question. I mean, no. Of course I would.
you wouldn't be like Joan Crawford. I mean, you brought her up.
Yeah, I know, but that's not what she did. She just didn't give them money because okay. She had it, and you know. But you know, money and love are and wisdom are two different things. I mean, I never got that from my father. But
there are benefits of tough love.
But yeah, no, I would definitely do that for my children. And in fact, I'm looking forward to some of my friends having kids so that I can be the lucky uncle. Unfortunately, you know, it seems like smart people aren't really having kids anymore.
Hmm. Hmm. Well, that's a topic for another show, I think.
Yeah.
But,
Gary, think about it.
There's a lot here. We know it's late out there, in New York. Thank you so much for being on with us, and we look forward to the film doing well out here and you doing well with what you're doing, spreading the new message that you have to spread.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Good luck.
Thank you. Mom. You too. All right. Wow. Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you, Ramon.
My pleasure.
It's been amazing. I mean, when does somebody have that experience, not just to get to ask these questions, but to talk to somebody that and listen to somebody that has had these experiences. Well, and there'll be more. There'll be more if you go and see Glory Days, The Life and Times of Michael Alec, and give us a website that we can learn more about this.
HollywoodFilmFestival.com. Yeah. Should have all of the information.
It does.
The premiere will be Thursday the 24th and Saturday the 26th of September at the Arclight, Theater Number 14. See you there. It's going to be a great time.
Excellent. So HollywoodFilmFestivals.com/film/glory-days, actually. All right. Well, we
days,
wish you...
D-A-Z-E.
We wish you... Yeah, D-A-Z-E. We wish you all the best with your acting, your writing.
Thank you.
And now your directing. We look forward to your next film as well.
We'll see where
it
goes.
Be interesting what story you pick. And when you play a happy guy, because you're a funny guy. When you play that funny guy, I'd love to see that too.
I'll bring in my comedic debut straight here.
You let us know.
And maybe we'll have a Life Changes film in the future.
That'll be great.
Nice. All right. Okay. Thank you, Ramon. When we come back, we're going to have music by Kaylee and the Jays here on the Life Changes Show.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening. Someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
The Life Changes Show is a premier radio show presented by the Life Changes Network, which is a company whose team has dedicated their lives not only to positive change, but to helping others observe and embrace, honor, and even celebrate their own changes, thus enabling a more positive, inspired life and helping to create a more positive and inspired world. From everyday people, celebrities, corporate giants, and children, we are here to help and to serve. With heart, integrity, and experience, we bring our message and positive intent into your lives through the Life Changes Show, LifeChangesNetwork.com, and through guest appearances on other inspiring shows and events. If you wish to learn more about Life Changes Life Coaching, a private consultation with one of us, corporate or live event appearances, or if you would like us to appear on your radio or TV shows, please email us at info@lifechangesnetwork.com.
We are back, and wow, after that conversation we had with Ramon Fernandez, who went from actor and writer to behind the camera and became a director, we actually have Kaylee Robin, who's here with Kaylee and the Jays, and we actually met her as an artist, and so she's an artist, a model, an actress, and now she's getting in front of the microphone, and so welcome Kaylee Robin and the Jays to the show.
Hello.
Hello.
So what possessed you to add yet another artistry to your already long list?
Oh, geez. You know, it was just everybody... You got to pick one. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to pick one more. Well, singing, I've always had a huge respect for music. Of course, everybody loves music. It lets you go. It lets you be free, you know. I never knew I could sing until just a couple years ago when I actually let it out and gave it a shot. And it wasn't until my mother actually overheard me singing in the basement. I didn't know anybody was home. And she came in and she's like, oh my God, Kaylee, you need to sing. And I was like, get out of here. I can't sing. Leave me alone. You know, and she forced me to sing at her open mic night. And I sang a cappella, like, 6 covers just by myself, and it was awesome, and it felt really awesome. And it was, at that point, I didn't even care how I sounded. Everybody was captivated. They all loved it. Sing another one, you know, and I felt really good about it. And it was fun. The adrenaline was awesome. And it was amazing. It was just
everybody
great.
Should sing.
Everybody should sing. Why not?
In the shower. Yeah. Is there a karaoke
in
for the shower?
Oh,
I mean,
man.
That would waste a lot of water. But you know, we don't want to do that in California. But isn't that a good idea?
Really, though.
So, you know, but let me ask you, this is different with your artistry because you started... What, 5, 6 years old?
Man, I've been drawing since I could hold a pencil. You know, it started off with just like scribbling like a little balloon people and heart people and flower people and then eventually real people. And I didn't start painting until I was 21. And I really enjoy oil painting as well. But everybody says that I have a strong point in the graphite portraits and all. I guess the longest experience in that. But people that only know me as an actress, they respect my acting. And people that only know me as a model, they're like, oh, why weren't you on America's Top Model? No, you know, Next Top Model and all of this. And people that have heard my singing that don't know that I do anything other than singing, they love it. You know, they think it's gorgeous and beautiful and wonderful. And I'm just soaking it up. I'm finding myself too, you know. And I'm being myself.
You're being Kaylee Robin.
Exactly.
And we're so much more than just one thing, aren't we?
Oh yeah. You can't just pick one. Everybody tell me pick one. I was like, you pick one. You know. And then
for
they
yourself,
go,
not
well,
for
what?
You.
No, right. No. I'll even say them for me. I'll be like, okay, which one should I do then? And they're like, well, because they don't know either.
All right, then.
Exactly. They're like, well, you're really good at drawing, but I really like that song you did. I don't know. Just keep doing you. And exactly. That's all I'm going to do is I'm just going to keep being myself.
You're going to keep being yourself. Yeah. Actually, you're going to be singing about being yourself in just a minute. You are known now as Kaylee and the Jays. And although we only have one J here today, so it's Kaylee and the J today. We have Jerry in the studio and he's going to play guitar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
And Kaylee, you wrote this song that you're going to sing?
Yeah.
What's it called?
Well, we have a couple songs. First one is called Feeling Human.
Feeling Human?
Yeah. Like we're feeling human.
Okay.
You know, because we all are human. And we go through all these certain emotions that tear us down and build us up and take us on different journeys. But it's all just part of being human, you know? Like, don't judge yourself for it. Don't be so hard on yourself for it. Just know that you're human just like everybody else.
Does that remind you of a story?
Exactly. And as he was talking...
Michael Alec,
yeah,
right?
The whole time Michael was talking, I was like, oh, man, our song's going to go perfect with this.
Right. I don't think Michael's on the line, but we'll have to make sure he gets this link.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And he gets to hear you do... Is it feeling, like N apostrophe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because...
All right.
It has a better flow than feeling human, right?
Oh, okay.
Feeling human.
Well, you know what?
That's what humans do.
That's what we do. We feel it.
Nice.
Take off the G.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. So even though John, the keyboardist, is not here with us today, we're going to still say, here's Kaylee and the Jays.
Yes, of course.
Singing Feeling Human on the Life Changes Show.
Feel hate.
know what it does to me. Keep testing my fate, controlling my destiny. When I feel low, it gets the best of me, but it keeps me alive if I give it the rest of me. Step out of my mind and realize that it's human. I take a moment to breathe to keep these dark clouds from looming. Now let's quiet the voices, keep the beatbox booming, booming, yeah. So frightening. When I feel peace, it's all so delighting. You should try it sometime, it can be so enlightening. All of these emotions have me feeling so human. I step out of my mind and realize that it's human. I take a moment to breathe to keep these dark clouds from looming. So let's quiet the voices, keep the beatbox booming, booming, yeah. 'Cause we're only human. Yeah, we're
nice. Kaylee and the Jays. Kaylee Robin. Kaylee is spelled K-A-Y-L-E-E.
Yes.
I know you know that. I'm sharing it with everybody else. And so if you go to KayleeRobin.com, you'll find Kaylee Robin. Now, this is so new that
my
you
music's
don't even
not
have
even
music
on it
on
yet.
There.
No, it's not. It is. It's fairly new. Like we're kind of a baby band, I guess. He's been doing music. Jerry's been doing music forever, but so I'm so blessed to have him.
Yeah, and you're right. It fits. I could have seen it as the backing track on a couple of those scenes.
We got a new soundtrack.
We got a new soundtrack. Yeah, perfect.
Awesome. Exactly. Well, yeah. You know, can I venture to say, since this has been a day of firsts, actually, we've never had anybody that spent that much time in jail, and we know of it, on the show. We've never had anybody reference Joan Crawford. Actually, that was a first. And am I correct in assuming this is your first radio interview as a singer?
Yes, it is.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Well, thank you. I am so pleased to be here.
Well, we are pleased to have you. Thank you. We are pleased to know that you're going to share another song with us?
Yes, we have another song. We have another. It's to lighten up the mood a little bit.
Is the next one called We're More Than Humans?
Pretty much, actually. It's Seriously? Kind of about being more than human.
Get out. What's it called?
No, it's totally about being human as well because, you know, we're only human. But, this is a fairly new song, and we call it Peace Chakra because it's like our nicest, prettiest, most peaceful song that we have right now.
Oh.
Because we have kind of a heavier tone. I don't know if you can tell from the last song. It's kind of dark sounding a little bit. Not too bad.
I'm picking Nothing up your crazy. Vibe. Your vibe is not dark at all.
No,
so,
it's not. It's not. But that's kind of so that bluesy, dark sort of heavy feel
kind
comes
of
out.
Positively dark.
It's positive. The words dark. Are encouraging.
Kind of like night.
But the music, it's, you know, it relates to a lot of, you know, anyways. So we call it Peace Chakra, but might just stick.
This is Peace Chakra. Well, this kind of applies too because Michael's saying like the new cool thing is meditation.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, no, it's perfect. So,
okay. It's perfect. Well, here's Kaylee and the Jays with Peace Chakra on the Life Changes Show. Nice. I really enjoyed that. sweet. That was sweet. Well, Kaylee Robin and Kaylee and the Jays.
Yes.
Thank you so much. That was sweet. That was, you know, Mark, my hat's off to you because you discovered her.
Thank you, and, Mark. I appreciate
and,
you a lot.
And he's so picky and he meets you and says, we have to have her on the show. I'm Yay. Like, as what?
Were you in the subway with a hat out?
No, she had her paintings. She had her paintings. And I'm like, as what?
Yeah, I know. I started talking about, because I was there like as a host and I had my artwork out and I was doing some modeling. I walked the runway that same day and I performed on stage as a singer that day. So it's kind of like this whole...
Well, and just... she lit up in talking about the singing. But then the other interesting thing is that there aren't that many people that are finding their way in this kind of bluesy, heavier frequency or sound, yet trying to bring something positive through the message.
Exactly.
So you're kind of getting people, we talk about, you know, resonance, and you know, I'm speaking a lot about this, right? We are what we consume in the way we hear and see, and yet there's a body of work out there of people that go back and listen to the same old sad songs or broken songs or bluesy songs. Yeah. And we don't want to get rid of all that, right? Mm-hmm. But yet to be able to
beautiful.
Bring...
That's wonderful music.
Exactly. But to bring a positive message mm-hmm. in as well.
It just resonates and, sometimes so
And then
heavy.
To be able to get that out there. And I believe she's going to be able to speak to a whole body of a large audience that are going to resonate with that frequency and yet hear and affirm the positive message that she's bringing through.
Another thing that I do identify with is obviously what we were talking about before, the whole thing of wanting to be an artist versus needing to be. And,
right.
Like with me, you know what I mean? I could do photography and I had 3 exhibits in New York and then I put my flyer on it and
right.
I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, just do some animation.
Like,
you know, exactly. Yeah. So it seems like you're on the same type of track.
Yeah, it's
know,
definitely, just, when you guys were saying that about yeah. the wanting or needing to be an artist yeah. and I need to be an artist, like, right. Not only do I want to be an artist, I of love course. It. I love what I'm doing, but I need to. I can't see myself fitting in any other way. I have too many different artistic outlets that I feel I'm actually not bad at, you know, like that I'm pretty good at, that I feel I excel in. And so to go any other direction, like I can't just hang up my artist coat and put on a suit or something. You know, right. it's not going to work. I'm right. going to fall asleep on my desk.
Right.
Yeah. What do we call this show?
And to give yourself the room to fail.
Yeah.
And get up and try it again.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
and not necessarily be judged
to
like
do
they
it.
Do on either American Idol or whatever, where they say, you suck, go away.
Right. I already
it's
had
like, well,
that,
you're supposed
you know?
To suck. You're just getting started. You let a person
well,
suck.
Well, she's just getting started.
She's amazing.
But she doesn't suck.
She does not suck.
Thank
on the
you.
Contrary.
Thank you.
No,
it's funny because when I was a little kid, I was always a big fan of rock and roll. And my dad was a huge rock and roll fan. And Led Zeppelin was on the radio. And I thought I'd try to sing along to it. I was really young. And I didn't know how to sing, especially Led Zeppelin. I'm still struggling with that. And he was like, babe, just leave it to the radio, you know, and it crushed my soul. And, you know, he had no idea. And I've sent him music since then. And he's like, oh, my God, my baby's a rock star, you know, and he had no idea either. And it's funny because my whole life, I can't sing, I can't sing, I can't sing. And then one day
well,
I was
you
like,
can change
I can't
that mantra,
sing,
then.
I can't yeah,
that,
sing,
that may
I can't
be another
sing.
Area.
Life changes.
Exactly, life changes.
Yes,
he's
does,
trying to compete
does.
With Robert Plant at 5.
Well, Mark said earlier that you're going to be able to reach a large audience, mm-hmm. and she already has. So
indeed.
As of just now,
yes.
you've reached a large
yeah.
audience.
Good.
So hats off to you.
Thank you.
Larger and larger audiences. And we look forward to meeting you down the road a little bit and seeing how this and everything else has progressed. It's been
wonderful.
A pleasure.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
KayleeRobin.com. It's been a pleasure.
Yes.
So thank you, Kaylee. And thank you, one of the Jays. Jerry.
He goes by Jay. You can just call
thank
him Jay.
Jay.
It's just Kaylee and a Jay today.
He's the Jay today. That's good. That feels good, right?
Thank you, Ramon. It's been a pleasure getting to know you.
My pleasure.
And having you on the show, Ramon Fernandez, everybody.
Brilliant work with
yes.
Glory Days.
Thank you.
Yes.
More power to you.
We wish you all the best with winning yet another and more festivals, we'll knock on wood.
Keep rolling the dice.
Glory Days. The Life and Times of Michael Alleg, and great to have him on, and what a conversation we had with him. Well, on behalf of Brent Hahn here in the studio at Studio NoHo and Doug Newsom at BBS Radio, and on behalf of Dorothy Donahue, our executive producer, and Mark Legere, our producer, I am Filippo Voltaggio reminding you, as your life changes, as ours just did,
yes,
we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at The Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.